Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think.
How does an actor create a character? And why is it that some of those characters seem to take on a life of their own? Lily Tomlin's characters have earned her 2 Tony Awards, 2 Peabodys, 6 Emmys, a Grammy, a Drama Desk Award, and the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. Moreover, some of the most enduring of them, Ernestine, Edith Ann, Trudy the Bag Lady, are familiar by one name only more than 30 years after their birth. Lily Tomlin is in town to perform a one-woman show tonight at the Addison Improv to benefit the Dallas Zoo's lonely elephant, Jenny, and we are delighted that she would make time to be with us. Lily, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Happy to be here.
Jenny is not the first elephant that you've become really passionate about.
No. I've worked a bit in L.A. with our Los Angeles elephants. Yeah, we have stuff going on there too. But because elephants confined elephants go through a lot of trauma and disease and disability and mental and physical. And so Jenny, I came specifically to advocate for Jenny because in the community you begin to learn about other elephants in other cities, and Jenny had such a specifically personal, you know, mental and physical disability and has had it for so long. And she's just particularly traumatized. They call elephants like the special needs elephants. And so we've been advocating. They're going to build a new habitat anyway, but it won't be done for at least a couple of years. And Jenny's 32. She's been here 22 years. She's gone through a lot of, you know, self-mutilating, and they have to drug her to keep her non-aggressive. And there's a wonderful place in Tennessee, the Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee. And they want Jenny. They'll transport her, and we just have to, you know, get the mayor's office and citizens of Dallas to advocate for Jenny to be transported there, and she can be healed at the sanctuary. I believe she can lead a much more normal elephant life. I mean, they have 2,700 acres there, 300 just for the African elephants alone, because African and Asian elephants do not coexist. They don't even speak the same language. And so, and they roll. I mean, they just—it's like a—it's like an elephant heaven, you know.
So I know that you've lobbied about this for a while. You spoke yesterday to City Council publicly, but you've made phone calls before this,
right?
And I know you met with the mayor and all that.
I met with the mayor today.
Yeah, can you talk about? Did you convince him?
I think it's a process, you know. You just have to keep advocating, because people come from different levels of awareness or feeling or interest for different subjects. I felt that I brought him Jenny's medical records, because everything is clear in her medical records, which are available online. They haven't been published since May of 2008, but even then she was still being drugged. Anyway, I gave I left the medical records with the mayor, and he promised me he would read them, and I'm looking forward to that because they're pretty convincing. And we talked about many different things. You know, there's a lot of politics that go on in any kind of city administration, and the zoo is part of that city, and there's other considerations that are made. But you know, this is the best thing for Jenny, and somebody in the city government, and in the zoo, and all those facilities, someone's got to be there. And I'm hoping someone will be convinced to start to really make Jenny's welfare a priority rather than some other consideration. Because after they get the habitat, this could be a win-win situation for everybody, for the mayor, for the council, for the zoo director, Greg Hudson. If they would send Jenny to the sanctuary now, because she's suffering now. She doesn't have to, she can't wait 2 years for the habitat to be built. And heaven only knows when that will get finished. You know how it is with a city and a big project, and takes money and time and all that effort. In the meantime, she could go to the sanctuary. She gets to retire, and she gets to have maybe a chance at a better life and no more suffering. I mean, foot abscesses. I know that yesterday I talked about her foot abscesses at the council, and somebody from the zoo kind of disputed that she doesn't have, but she may not have one at the moment. But she's had them recurring over her whole history, and you can read about it in the medical records of Jenny. I mean, she's repeatedly had chronic foot abscesses, and they're excruciating, painful. Anyway, so then when the habitat gets built, then they can get some poor elephant that's out there somewhere living in someone's backyard and being terribly abused and confined, or they can get an elephant that's chained somewhere in a roadside zoo and never gets to do anything much either. and bring them to the habitat, and they get a little upgrade. And slowly, maybe we can improve the lives of all the elephants that are in captivity here in the country.
So Jenny doesn't have to stay here and wait for the habitat.
No, and with Jenny's problems, we're not even sure the habitat would serve Jenny. She just is not an elephant that is easily... she has special needs. There's nothing more you can say about it. She's had terrible, terrible trauma all her life, and she does not react well to stress. That's why she has to be drugged. And she doesn't have the, you know, she's lived 22 years on less than a third of an acre. And elephants roam 35, 40 miles a day in the wild. They're made to do that. That's their whole life, is constant movement, mental and physical. I mean, they're smart as heck. They're very playful. They have lots of activities, and they like to pull up, you know, brush and tree stumps, and they like to roll in the mud, and they run, they climb, and they cannot be on a hard surface like concrete or. And when you weigh 10,000 pounds, you're going to compact the earth if you stand on it day after day after day. So, and she needs companionship, a companion that she can choose, not a companion that's foisted on her in a relatively tiny place. It's like, you know, living in a closet with somebody you don't like.
Lily Tomlin is my guest. She's in town to do a benefit tonight at the Addison Improv for Jenny the Elephant. You can find information about that on our website, the think page of KERA.org. So I know that you write most of your characters with your partner, Jane.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, even yesterday, if you sort of wrote that address, if that's the kind of thing that you work on together and kind of vet together.
No, we didn't do that. No, I mostly did that just from all the reading and the stuff I've done over the recent past, and learning about Jenny and what I know about elephants in general and so on. In fact, if anybody else wants to advocate for Jenny, if you go to on the web, there's a site, concernedcitizensforjenny.net, because all you really need to do is, if you're so inclined, and I hope you are, just, you know, email the city council, email the mayor, make phone calls, let the city know that this could be a magnificent thing that the city of Dallas does. You not only send Jenny to a sanctuary and make her life better, but you then are able to upgrade some other elephant who's really suffering out there and put her in the new habitat. And I think the city would be something the city would be proud of. I think the international community, especially people who are aware of animals, would applaud the city. I'd like the mayor to take some of that credit and responsibility. It would be great for him, too.
So the show tonight will be a lot of the characters people are familiar with already.
Yeah, probably do 10 or so characters and try to talk about Dallas a little bit and talk about Jenny and talk about the election coming up a little bit, but mostly try to be funny and in the voice of different characters like Ernestine and Edith and Mrs. Beasley and Sister Boogie Woman and all kinds of people. My mother, Lud and Marie, who are fictitiously named, you know, to disguise my mother and father's identity.
Oh, okay.
And
we have a clip here. Let's listen to a little bit of Ernestine, and people can remember if they don't already how great she is.
Gracious, good afternoon. This is Miss Tomlin, your repairs operator. Oh, Vito, hi. Oh, they've got you working today too, so early. It's only noon. Why do those people have to have their phones fixed in such a rush? Why can't they just go to the corner and use our semi-convenient payphone? Oh, that's broken too. Well, just what do they claim is wrong with their instrument and/or service? Oh, other voices on the line. Isn't that picky? $12.50 a month doesn't buy perfection. Oh, listen, Vito. Vito, what's the house like? Where are you? In the living room? All maple and chintz? I love it. Bet it's got one of those cute little telephone tables with a special place for the directory. I knew it. Well, Vito, what about the rest of the house? Well, do the Mr. and Mrs. sleep together? Well, pretend you have to check a wire. Go take a look. I'm a lineman for the county. And I work the main... Vito, I'm here, yes? So what about the bedroom? No kidding. No wonder she's so crabby. Has she given you anything to eat yet? Not even a can of beer? Put her on, let me talk to her. Listen, you, This is Miss Tomlin with a word for you about common manners. You just listen to me and don't interrupt. Your repairman is a human being, too. And the sooner you people realize it, the quicker you're going to get your phones fixed. Now, just a second. I'm just going to say this once very clearly. You want service on your line? You want to be able to report a fire, call a loved one far away? You get your little fanny out to that early American kitchen and get Vito something to eat and drink. You got 1 minute. Now move. Vito, is she doing it? Running to the kitchen. If we play our cards right, you can have lunch there every day this week. Fix the phones, I don't know, about cocktail time on Friday. Good. Oh, listen, my board's lighting up. But if she doesn't come up with something better than a you need a biscuit and a cup of soup, you call me back. Oh, Vito, before you leave today, why don't you short sheet their bunk beds?
I haven't heard that in so many years. That was done in 1971.
Yeah, it's great. It's such there are so many things that are sort of frozen in time, and yet they're still really funny.
Yeah, so that's a long. Now Ernestine, you know, with the divestiture and everything, she has no power after the monopoly was broken up. She now, you know, lately she's been working at a big insurance corp, so she can deny health care to everyone.
Has she been taken over by the government?
No, but she's, you know, she just likes power. She'll do anything for to be able to, you know, put someone on hold or deny their needs.
Richard Pryor said one time that you were the only other person he knew that became possessed by your characters. Do you agree with that?
Maybe, kind of in a way. I mean, I don't, you know, they do. Ernestine specifically, I always thought of her as someone like Betty Davis and that I was just one of the many people who imitated her. That she was, because so many people in the old days, when she was so high on television, you know, people, kids would. And I met a woman who, she's grown now, but she said when she was a little girl, she had made herself a little toy switchboard. and housewives used to send me pictures of them, so they'd use their stove, like those old stoves that had the oven up here and then the burners to the, like a right angle. And they would sit there, they'd send pictures with kind of done up as Ernestine, pretending they were plugging into the oven. You know, so Ernestine was just like, bigger than I was, that I felt I was in her service as well.
Do you start, when you're creating a new character, do you start with one little quality and think, who can I build around this? Or does something sort of inchoate come into your head and then you just refine?
You know, there's no form. If there were a formula, I would do it as often as I could. No, sometimes they come, you may just deliberately want to do a culture type. And like when I started Ernestine, I didn't plan on her, how she came out. I wasn't on television or anything. I was just working in small clubs in New York. And I was thinking about doing like a New York operator because it was the mid, late 60s. And I thought everybody hated the phone company. They were a monopoly. AT&T was a big monopoly. And their political activities were suspect, as they still are. I found out later when I became famous, the Communication Workers of America invited me to different benefits and parties and stuff, and they confessed to me that in those days the service was so bad and the repair, you couldn't get a phone, you couldn't get a new phone, you couldn't get a phone that fixed. They would, because they were letting their private subscribers just deteriorate because they had no recourse.
Wow.
And they were spending all their R&D on databasing for corporations. And so people were just up in arms about, especially in New York, about the phone company. So I was going to do a tough New York operator. But as I worked on Ernestine and kind of improv and fooled around, it was like that petty power was so suppressed sexually.
We're back in just a minute with Lily Tomlin.
On that
talking
note.
About Ernestine. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd.
Grayson?
Yes, madam?
Don't forget to pick up the invitations and make sure they're hand-delivered the moment I die.
The moment you die? Yes, madam.
Mr.
Cobb.
Cobb. Oh, yes, you're the tedious one. Would you mind accompanying me back to my desk there?
Yes,
now, here's the name of my caterer. And the evening's menu, make sure they include plenty of goose pate.
Excuse
it's
me.
Marvelous.
This is for the funeral?
One does not have goose pate at a funeral.
Now, Mr. Fulton Norris has a wonderful society orchestra. I should like you to engage him for the entire weekend.
This is a wake, then?
Heavens no, it's for a party, and I want it to be a corker. Guess what I'm going to do?
What?
I'm going to come back from the dead.
Oh. And, what makes you think you can do that?
Because I'm rich.
That was Lily Tomlin in All of Me. You also heard Steve Martin there. We are talking to her today about her career and about her interest in Jenny the Elephant. You can join our conversation by calling.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
I'm struck listening a little while ago to Ernestine and talking to you here and then listening to that piece, how different your voice sounds in every role. Is that where you start with the voice as opposed to the way your body moves?
Well, on the stage, I mean, in a movie or something, you have scenery and costumes and all kinds of things to help support whatever it is you're trying to do. On the stage, because I don't work with anything, I don't wear any costumes or anything like that. So, in that sense, you try to make a character as physically specific as you can so that when I jump from character cut, I think of the stage more as filmic in a way because I think of it as cuts, film cuts. When you go to one character and come back to another, or go to another, or two or more are talking to one another at the same time, you try to physicalize them and vocalize them in a way that people don't get lost, you know. And I started that, I think, from growing up. First of all, I was a kid that listened to radio because we didn't get a TV till I was 10, and then I had teachers in school. One in particular, Mrs. Goldberg, who's since died. But I kept in touch with her for a long time, and she would read those old dialect poems to us that are probably, you know, politically incorrect now, and they don't have them in the system, like old Italian, German, Swedish, Black.
We had an accent, basically. Accent-based.
They were written phonetically, you know, like, you know for why the school keep out this holiday, my son? Well, they're not going to tell you about little Georgia Washington, you know? And I was just sort of mesmerized by that, too, because there would be a story, you know, it would be a whole scenario. And people talking to one another, and I thought that was just so funny and divine. So maybe it did start there. I don't know exactly. And sometimes it is a gesture, as you were suggesting. Someone like Ernestine, as I was saying before, I think that's why she was so popular, is because she was so organic. Because as I threatened people, my body got tighter and tighter, and my face got tight. And when my face was tight, it made me snort a little bit, you know, and it was just like kind of serendipitous. So I don't know. And then sometimes you get sometimes you just kind of whole cloth. You just are, you know, you approach a character and you're trying to make it come to life and be something and communicate something. And I don't know. It comes by a gesture. It comes by a voice. It comes sometimes by a phrase. Like I used to do a quadriplegic in my first Broadway show, Crystal the Terrible Tumbleweed. And she was going cross country in her chair, her motorized chair. Well, she had a blow pad chair. And, I mean, she could manipulate the chair
with her breath,
right? And she was going cross country from the Palisades in New Jersey to Big Sur in California, and she was going to go hang gliding. And subsequent to that, lots of people with physical disabilities have been hang gliding since then. I don't think they had necessarily done it before. And so she kind of became a standard bearer. You know, she talks about her protest, how she'd roll up the hill, Capitol Hill, and then roll back down. And she was just outrageous and wonderful. But she came about because a mother that I used to correspond with had a physically disabled kid. And she said, Lily, you just got to do somebody with physical disabilities. And I said, I can't find a way into it. You know, I don't know and she said, so she told me a story about going to an amusement park with a friend of hers, an adult who was in a chair, and a kid came up to her and said to the person in the chair, hey, are you a ride? And I thought, oh, it was epiphanous. You know, I suddenly could see the whole personality of Crystal and what she would do.
It would seem like some characters, well, the ones that you create for yourself, you have control over when they come about and what you do with them. But then you do a lot of movies where someone else has written something very often before you were even associated with the project.
Right.
How different is it when there's someone else really directing your performance and you've been given a set of words to say that you can't manipulate?
Well, it's harder that is a little harder. I've gotten more used to it. But in the beginning, because 9 to 5 was like the third movie I made, and I just couldn't somehow get into Violet, or the character's name was Violet Newstead. And the only way I was able to do it, when they'd come and knock on our trailer and tell us it was time to go to set, I'd pretend that Jane and Dolly and I were making an educational film about office workers. And I don't know why it sort of worked for me. Then I could kind of get into it. And, you know, and I would forever talk with Colin, the director, Colin Higgins, always wanting to insert some business or something, you know. And he let me do a little bit of it, you know, if it didn't interfere with his vision. Like, I kept saying, why would Violet? She's so spunky. I said, she's got to have more kids. She doesn't have enough kids to make her stay at the job. And so I said, can I have like some triplet bluebirds? And if you look in the scene when I'm in the garage with my son, way in the distance out the window, you can see these three little girls in uniform with my mother, because he was just being nice to me, really, you know.
So you had to have the money, basically, to motivate the character.
I wanted to believe that she had enough kids that she just couldn't change jobs that easily, you know.
What's the best and worst kind of director for you?
I guess someone who kind of puts the lid on you, who they, you know, it gets, sometimes you make a movie and in big business, Bette and I had, the director, Jim Abrams, is a really sweet guy, but it was like either we didn't know what to do except do what we did, and he didn't know what to do with us in a certain kind of way, because he stopped us on everything we were going to do. You know, it got to a point where I had to actually audition if I wanted to do some business or something in the scene, blocking or something. I had to audition it, like that thing with the snake that I do, where I shake my bracelet.
Yeah.
and I go like I'm snaking somebody, one of my twin characters, because that was based on the fact that, first of all, she's from like the Appalachia, and she's very religious and fundamentalist. And I'm from Detroit, but my family's from Kentucky, and I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church and everything. And anyway, when they brought me my costume for that day, they brought me that bracelet with all those little loose
jangling
beads.
Yeah.
And so I started shaking that bracelet, and then it just came out of that. And it was so organic. And they didn't want me to do it. They kept stopping me from doing it. And I said, please, please let me just do one take. And it got such a big laugh in from the executives that then they put it about four times in the movie, which I wouldn't have done. But so sometimes you have that problem. And then someone like Altman, and probably those are many of some of the best things I've done, is because he's so freewheeling. He's so unflappable. And before you really know, you might say, an actor will say, well, what do you see in this scene or something? And he'd say, well, I'm not sure. Why don't you surprise me?
So one extreme or the other.
Yeah,
Let's go back for a second and listen to a little bit of Big Business.
Good morning, Judy. Come on, Duke.
Oh, hi, Rose.
I know I'm late. It's just I got to walking in the park, and it was so beautiful, and I found this cute little guy, and he was lost. And
Rose,
I think I'm going to call him Duke, because I've always wanted to have a dog named Duke.
Go.
Oh, Duke! Oh, what have I done, Judy?
Push a button.
Oh, call someone.
The down button,
Do something,
Rose.
Duke.
Calm down.
Oh, help me.
You'll
call the
right.
Security. Oh, Duke!
See? There he is.
Oh, Duke, you're okay. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do it. It's all right. I deserve it.
Oh. Rose, why don't I take Duke while you're in the meeting?
Oh, the meeting. Oh, I almost forgot. I'm just not myself today.
Oh. Or any other day.
You're late. The meeting's in 2 minutes.
I know, but Sadie, do I have to go? I sit there and everyone looks at me like I'm, you know, because, and especially today, I'm just not grounded. I'm not centered in the way I should be. Because last night, Dr. G and I, we were having this candlelight dinner and, you know, too much wine. I started opening up, and I mean, he started closing up like he usually does, but I started talking about getting married and having kids and maybe a goat and some ducks and a little garden with fresh veggies. You know how I love to chop and find
what happened?
Oh, we broke up.
Good riddance. You are so completely out of sync.
You're dreaming about growing old in the country while other women your age.
Our age?
Don't interrupt. I'm thinking about tummy tucks. I tell you, it's not normal. Now stop it. Stop it. Do you want one of the board members to see you? I'll say you're a sniveling, hysterical, pre-periodic twit.
I have a right to my own feelings, Sadie, and I am not a twit. I may be pre-periodic and I may be hysterical. So what?
So there are drugs for those things, and we make most of them. Now get in there.
I could just kick myself when I act this way.
Splash some water on your face and maintain.
That was Lily Tomlin and, of course, Bette Midler in the movie Big Business.
I liked listening to it. It was kind of fun.
Well, it's so fun. The premise of that movie is so ridiculous to begin with, but it works so well. And I think a lot of it is based on the chemistry that you have with Bette Midler. And I'm wondering, there have to be times when you're called upon to have chemistry with someone that you just don't get along with or you just don't feel it with. Have you learned tricks to fake that, to force it?
No, I haven't. I did have in one movie I made, I didn't have that much. It suited the relationship I was supposed to, and I just used it. I mean, I so would get so ticked off at things that this person would say, you know, in the makeup room and stuff, and I would just use it because I was supposed to be adversarial.
That's helpful.
Yeah, so it was good because I really, like, sometimes just lose it. I just, you know, just go a little nuts because some of that would be brought into the scene from the other actor's perspective. I'm not even going to say if it's a man or a woman, Sam. Being very cagey.
That's very, very tasteful of you. Have you ever thought about directing yourself?
I don't think I could direct. I could direct something that I knew very well, like autobiographical story. Like there's many things that I would like to direct that I, you know, just because they're another stage to take something that I've done, like. And this is one of my favorite stories. This is not exactly – I don't perform this at all. This is just one of those old stories that are true. And that is my brother and I, back in Detroit, I used to say we were the only family who didn't have a car.
And so In Detroit,
right. So finally we get a car. My Aunt Irma D was married to Walt, who had a bunch of body shops. And so he sold my dad an old Opel. It was a 58, but he 57, but he told my father it was a 58. So that caused a big family schism when the pink slip came and the car was a year older. Anyway, so my brother and I would go out every night. I mean, we were just, I was probably about 17 and he's about 14. And we'd even drink Geritol so we could stay up late at night and drive, you know, drive all night.
Is that the Red Bull of its day?
Yeah, the Red Bull of its day, right. So that's good. I wish I'd thought of that. So, one weekend we're out at a party on the other side of town, and when we get in the car and start driving, we suddenly realize someone's following us with their lights off, and we're real scary anyway. But my brother's worse than I am, and I was a good driver. I was in Detroit. I drove a stick shift and all that stuff, you know, from the time I could, and I could not get rid of it. This car chased us everywhere, and there was nothing was open, lights, no gas stations, till we built up such a terror that I finally said, let's just run to the house, throw open the doors, run for the porch, and get in as fast as we can. And so we did. We did that. We were shaking so bad we can't get the damn key in the door. And I looked back over my shoulder, and we had hooked an Isetta to our bumper. Some people don't even know anymore what an Isetta is, but it's like a little. It would be like a little smart car today, but it was only a three wheeler. With a great big bubble front on it. Do you remember
them? And it was just parked behind you. Yeah,
yeah. And somehow we'd gotten hooked together, and we dragged this car all the way across town. But it was terrifying because their lights were out. We couldn't tell exactly how close they were, but they were right on our tail, you know. So I've always wanted to make a little movie of that, like two teenagers out, and they just get hysterical, you know, with fear. And then you see that's what they've done. Sort of like Duel, that Duel film that Spielberg did years ago.
Are you a car person these days?
I used to be. You know, a big date in Detroit used to be to go down to the General Motors building and see the new Cadillacs. That would be like
really a
hot thing to do on the weekend, right? And no, I'm not. I still love cars. I still love old cars. I have a 55 Dodge Royal Lancer.
Wow. You drive that around a lot?
Sometimes I do. But, you know, once you drive a modern car, a new car with anti-lock brakes and stuff, you realize
airbags.
Just how treacherous it is sometimes driving a car with just old brakes from the 50s. They're just not the same as those brakes that stop on a dime. And I keep it up. I just had it re-chromed a little bit ago because it's got gorgeous chrome on it, great big bullet bumpers in the front and teeth. The radiator's got big teeth, you know.
Oh, and the weather's got to be great. You just roll down the windows and...
Yeah. No, and it's a hard top, and you open those little side windows, you know, create a breeze.
1-800-9.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
My guest is Lily Tomlin. Let's speak to Jack in Dallas. Hi, Jack.
Hi.
Hi, Jack.
Hi, Lily. A couple of comments. You're such an icon to our generation, and I just always love everything you do. Did you ever hear of Bert and I? They were a couple of divinity students from the Yale Divinity School.
No, gosh, no, heck.
They did a great thing on Essie and Winona Thicket, who ran a chowder house, and Essie did the books upstairs in her iron lung. you should try and look that up. Don't probably need any inspiration, but it's a great story.
Okay, that sounds great. I'd love to find it.
Those divinity students, I guess, are pretty edgy. Do people suggest characters for you sometimes? They say, you should do my mother-in-law.
Yeah, sometimes they do, yeah. But they what they'll sometimes do is, they do it a lot. I mean, people will see someone, friends will see somebody, like when they're traveling like this. Oh, we had this waitress in such and such a restaurant, and you got to go there and see her. She'd just be a great character and stuff like that. But most people don't. You have to be careful about, you know, people writing you and telling you that, especially if they give you some generic culture type like a postman or a teacher, you know, because it's not specific at all. But then if you did do a teacher, they think that was their idea.
Suddenly you're Art Buchwald and yeah.
Yeah, so I'm a little bit cautious about that. But the best part is when you do someone you know and you pluck a little something out of your history with them or... And they most of the time, 90% of the time, they don't recognize themselves. They'll say, oh, that's a scream or something. But when they do, it's not good. I had a and when I was starting out, I went and played at the Bitter End in New York. And my girlfriend that I'd known in high school and then college, she came backstage and she said, don't ever do me in your act again. And she was just like, really? Not happy about it. I didn't identify her in any way, but she did recognize her behavior.
Lily Tomlin is with us. We'll be back to Think in just a minute. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lily Tomlin. You can join us by calling 1-800.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
So I want to talk about this project that we around here are very sad that didn't go through, the 12 Miles of Bad Road.
Oh, yeah.
And you were playing a real estate agent and met with Ebbie Halliday. Is that right?
I did. Oh,
she's
yeah.
great, isn't she?
Oh, she's unbelievable. Fantastic. And she told me how she started out when she was a little girl. She'd ride horseback over the fields, you know, and sell clover salve. Isn't it called clover? Is it clover leaf?
It's probably clover. Yeah.
They still make it.
And, yeah.
And then her brother, somewhere she got the idea to say, I'm not going to say it right. And Ebbie, if you're out there, forgive me. But she'd say she finally had a little pitch because she's been phenomenally successful as a businesswoman and still goes to work every day, you know, and she's she must be in her 97 by now. Anyway, and she's just delightful. Plays a ukulele. She's full of life. She's just wonderful. Anyway, she made it. It was sort of like clover salve. It'll heal what ails you or something. And good for blah, 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 this and that and this and pregnancy. Or something.
Causing it, preventing it.
Yeah, something outrageously wonderful and ambiguous.
what did you take from the ethos of this place that you wanted to be part of the character you were playing? And I know it was a comedy.
Very much a comedy. And it was written and created by Linda Bloodworth, who created Designing Women, and Linda has a lot of good friends here in Texas too, and in Dallas. It was just a wonderful, rich tapestry to do. It was like a huge, sprawling, you know, kind of comedy soap opera, and I was the matriarch, and Mary Kay Place was my sister. And we were immensely rich. We didn't just do real estate. We did real estate sort of just because it was fun to do, and we were quite serious about it. We made anything. We did pay. But we also raised cattle and had oil, and we were just all over the place and very well positioned. And we'd been married to brothers, the Shakespeare brothers, so it was we were the Shakespeare family. And I and my children are pretty much out of control, you know, way too much money and no one disciplining them about anything. And it was just a lot of wonderful actors in it. But the people, the Chris Albrecht, who used to head up HBO, and he brought such hits as Sopranos and Six Feet Under and Sex and the City, and he was responsible for the real big success at HBO. Well, he did something fractious in public and slapped his girlfriend and got terrible publicity for it, and he got fired. And the people that came in, we were already filming 12 Miles. He had bought 10 of them, and they just didn't see eye to eye with the producers, and it just came into a very hard-headed impasse, you know, and they decided not to ever air it. They just put it on the shelf and stopped because the producers wouldn't do what they wanted them to do.
So
and it was just funny. And what?
You lost your champion, basically.
Yeah, we lost our champion, right. Mm-hmm. And that happens at the network sometimes. And we had the writer's strike, so we got stopped at six episodes we'd finished. We were just going to start the seventh, and that's when the writer's strike happened last year, and so we just never came back. But it was great. We had great clothes. We had incredible houses. In fact, we used one house here in Dallas. A friend of Linda Bloodworth, the creator, and her husband Harry Thomason, and you know, there were just things they didn't like in it. I had a granddaughter who was mentally challenged, but not. She was a wonderful actress, wonderful little actress. I thought she was doing a great job, and we were the Shakespeare family was determined to make her a Deb, you know. And it was just they were completely full of themselves, and it was just so much fun to do, because there's nothing like being immensely rich and having the biggest egos in the world and thinking you can just bend the planet to your will. And they had their own box. We came down here, and we didn't come down here, but they did shoot with the Cowboys and everything. We had a huge cachet with Dallas, and lots of people helped, and Jerry Jones helped us and all that stuff, because Linda and Harry had a lot of friends, and it was really fun to do. Anyway, I lament the loss of it too.
Yeah, I'm sorry that we won't get to see it. It must be hard to walk away from a character you've liked playing.
I had gorgeous hair. My hair was just
so someone did it all the time.
Yeah, well, I wore a red wig, you know, but it was really quite beautiful. I did love that.
Do you ever take a character, maybe one of the more realistic things you've played, and you have done several dramatic roles, do you ever take it out in public and just check how it is responded to?
Well, even characters that aren't that realistic. I mean, I've done lots of stuff with Ernestine in the streets and you know, or set up some little thing to do to film it and play it somewhere. Oh, in fact, I just went to the Emmys as Ernestine because they did this little tribute to Laugh In, and we had a joke wall and everything, and I always film it. I mean, Ernestine is kind of real to, you know, especially people in the industry or people who kind of grew up with her. I interviewed with everybody. It's really fun to do that, you know, go on Access Hollywood and E.T. And just act like Ernestine, you know. And then she always talks, you know, she thinks she's just done everything. Those characters that are really full of themselves are the most fun. In this recent thing, and I posted it because I contribute to this website called Women on the Web.
I saw, that's a great site.
Yeah, wow, oh, wow. So I always post little videos. And I last week or so, I posted one of Ernestine. And she's just talking about everybody who's political in Hollywood and how she counseled all of them. And she she politicized Michael Moore when he was a little boy. And he still calls her at night to reminisce about his day's activities. And how she gives him, and George Clooney, and anybody that does anything political, she says, because she used to listen in on everything on the board. You know, she listened to corporations and government officials. She knew everything that was
all
going.
The information.
Yeah, all the information, right.
1-800-9.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Let's go next to Daryl in Lancaster. Hi, Daryl.
Hello, and hello, Lily. Hi. I absolutely adore you.
Oh, Daryl, thanks.
I saw A Search for Signs at the Majestic, and my favorite character was the bag lady who kept up with all of her thoughts. It was a brilliant way to switch from scene to scene or character to character, because she put little post-it notes all up and down her arm.
Yeah, right, right.
That was absolutely inspired.
Thank you. Gosh, yes, thank you. Well, you know, the Search was written by my partner, Jane Wagner. But, of course, I loved doing it. I really did. It was really inspiring. I try to give the audience goosebumps, and I try to make them give me goosebumps.
Can she always, are there ever times when you have to say, how would you say this when she writes something? Or do you always know?
Oh, yeah, no. Well, I do intuit. I mean, I think our sensibilities are so close. And I know where she's going with something, but I never can know exactly how far. And then she always surprises me. When she was writing The Search, working underside of The Search. Trudy, the bag lady, had a line where she's talking about, because she's here, the aliens are here searching for signs of intelligent life, and they're stopping on Earth and looking. And Trudy's kind of their tour guide through humanity. And she says at one point, she says, frankly, I think they find us quite captivating. And my heart would just float up. And later, of course, it turned into something so much more beautiful and large, where Trudy's trying to teach the aliens about soup and art, and she shows them a can of Campbell's tomato soup, and she shows them a picture of Andy Warhol's painting of a can of Campbell's tomato soup, and she's trying to show them the difference between soup and art and soup. Of course, they never get it. And finally, at the end, she takes them to the theater to get goosebumps because she got them there once. And this is like the denouement of the play. And she says she forgot to tell them to watch the play. They've been watching the audience. Huh. And then they say they got goosebumps watching the audience. I mean, I'm paraphrasing it. And she says, yeah, they seeing a bunch of strangers sitting together laughing and crying about the same things just knocked them out. They said, Trudy, the play was soup, the audience art. And it's just such a great curtain line. And I get a little goosebumps just now because I have a big history with it. And that is the point of the play, is that trying to do all this disparate humanity and how sort of, you know, no matter how base we are, how magnificent we can be. And one of the best things that ever in a review that was ever written is someone wrote, at the end, we were on our feet applauding our higher selves. And I just love that so much.
Can you go back to the same works of whatever it is, a film or a piece of art or music? Does it have the same kick for you every time, or do things sort of lose their impact and you find yourself looking for something else that gives you goosebumps?
Yeah, sure. Things where you might be in a different frame of spirit or mind or something when you see it and you think, oh, I wonder why I love that so much. Or you see something that you didn't see something in it before, but when you and maybe you think much more highly of it. You know, maybe you weren't even conscious enough to realize how sort of great it was. I don't mean my own stuff. I'm just saying in general. But I tell you, when you're in the theater, this is why people are wed to the theater in their souls. If you ever do have an experience in the theater where it's so breathtaking, where an actor and a theme or an idea is so wed together that it just illuminates their humanity and your own. I mean, you seek it all the time. You might not. It might happen once in 50 times, you know, but it's enough to bring you back. Like I saw, I've seen the most esoteric things where something just comes together in a moment that so crystallizes something magnificent about life. And something like Reba McEntire, she did Annie Get Your Gun on Broadway, and she was so alive, so in the moment, so real. She was just illuminating her own humanity, so validated mine. And I sat down to see the play, and in 3 minutes I was weeping. And I wept through the whole play because she was so marvelous. And one time I was at the Grammys and Leontine Price came out and she began to sing a cappella. And it was like divinity. It was something divine. Just that voice in the air, it just sent, you know, these waves of something so gorgeous through you. And sometimes it happens, you know, it's just a wonderful thing.
Is that God for you?
Well, it's a kind of evidence of something God-like, you know, or some presence or some or just us in a way, just how close we are to some kind of magnificence.
What do you think about now when you're looking at a script and you're deciding whether you want to do something or not?
Well, I like something that either has an intelligence and it doesn't debase humanity. you know, has some point of view that it's hard. It's nothing you can put your finger on. It's your own sensibility. It's what sort of appeals to you, you know. I was given a script recently that may get green-lighted or may not. We won't know for whenever we find out in a few weeks. But it's just a kind of farcical thing, and it's called Sweet Baby Jesus, and it's set in the 70s, and it's about I'm an innkeeper, like a, you know, out in the country someplace, a young girl shows up who's pregnant, and her name happens to be Mary, and her boyfriend's name is Joseph. And I get it, and I'm quite religious, and I get it in my mind that this is going to be, you know, some kind of second coming, and it's going to be done by people who did Ab Fab and Fawlty Towers, and
oh wow,
that kind of outrageous kind of, you know, comedy, and I think it could be a lot of fun. I hope it goes. So I picked it because it's just interesting, it's fun, it's sort of fantastical, and yet it's kind of mysterious and strange, and the character's fun.
How hard is it to wait and find out if something, once you've decided you really want to do something, what is that like for you? Waiting to hear if it's green-lighted or not, or if it goes forward?
Well, maybe if you didn't have anything else to do, it would be more significant. But because I kind of do so much, like right now I'm shooting some Desperate Housewives, and I'm playing Mrs. McCluskey's sister. And Catherine Justin, who plays Mrs. McCluskey, she's such a scream anyway. Mm-hmm. And I met her on Murphy Brown years ago.
Oh.
She was one of Murphy's secretaries.
And you were Murphy's boss.
And
right?
I was Murphy's boss. And I just hit it off with her. And then she came. She was Mrs. Landingham on West Wing. Mm-hmm. And then after she got killed in a car wreck, her character did. You know, the president gave her a car. And she died as a result. And Chris, he was tormented by that. And then they waited a whole year to replace her. And then I replaced her just by coincidence. So that's always been a little joke between us. And so we were kind of active and doing different things. And I run into her at events. And we kept saying, well, why don't you come on Desperate Housewives and play my sister and stuff. So I'm doing a few. I'm just saying I'm doing that. I come out here to do this to lobby for Jenny. And I do 40 or 50 concerts a year. When I leave here, I'm going to go to Worcester, Mass on Saturday to do a show there. And I participate in that website, wowowwow.com. In fact, Jane, my partner, does a lot of environmental cartoons on that.
There's an elephant among her drawings.
Yeah, she's done a couple of elephant scenes.
Lily, it has really been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Have I been here all this time?
You've been here for an hour.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Lily Tomlin will appear tonight at the Addison Improv in a benefit for Jenny the Elephant. You can find information about that and a link to the Jenny the Elephant website on the Think page of KERA.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.